Welcome to the Wolf Connection Podcast. I'm your host, John Kalfa. Let's talk about some wolves. Today, joining Stephen and myself from her residence in Indian Hills, Colorado, she is the director and co-founder of Working Circle, Karen Vardaman. Karen, how are you? How's everything going with you?
Everything is fabulous. Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. Appreciate this opportunity to chat with you all.
Yeah, us too.
Yeah, I was doing some research before we started the podcast, and I came across this incredible article that was written, I believe it was a year or so ago, in the New Yorker, which is really where I got the sense of who you really are and your journey and how you got to create Working Circle. But you started as a marine conservationist, right? So how did you move from the sea onto the land and start working with wolves? How did that come about?
Well, it certainly wasn't something I planned. I really thought that I would be spending my entire career working at the Ocean Institute in Southern California. I loved it there. I was happy there. I just got to sail on the ships. And I think the New York article might have mentioned it, but I was looking for a new screensaver for my computer. And I was looking for a whale or a dolphin, marine mammal, right? Makes sense. Tall ship, perhaps. And I came across this picture of this wolf, you know, and it was the way it was looking at me. And I was fascinated because I love dogs. I'm a huge dog person. And I just kept staring at it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to pick that. And my colleagues were like, why do you have a wolf on your screen? I'm like, I don't know. So I started to read more about them. And I watched that movie, Never Cry Wolf, and cried my eyes out. And I just started to become fascinated with them. And then I went to the California Wolf Center. It was a surprise birthday present. Did not know I was going there. And that was it. It was all over. I signed up that day to be a volunteer. It was a 2-hour drive one way. And I went twice a week. Pretty soon I was taking vacation days to go. Signed up for anything and everything. Learned husbandry, you know, so I could take care of them. And I remember being so excited about cleaning up wolf poo. It was like, this is wolf poo. How cool is that? And getting involved in the education programs because of my background and going through any class that they offered. And I remember OR7 came in to California just thinking, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I volunteer here. We have our first wolf here in all these years. And they had this position for Northern California or California Wolf Recovery. I'm like, what a dream that would be. But, you know, I'm just this volunteer. I know nothing, you know. And so they had a gal that was doing it. And after a year, she got another position somewhere. This other gal was doing it. Then she was moving on and the position was open. And I thought, there's just no way. And well, it was offered to me and it changed my life. I was the new kid on the block, considering people have been doing this for, you know, 20 years at that time. But I think coming from maybe not having as much indoctrination helped me to see things a little differently. So that's how I got involved. You know, I took that leap of faith from a full-time job with benefits and retirement to half the pay and half the hours and never look back.
Man, that is awesome. I love those stories. And yes, if you're excited about scooping poop, we are too. Here, you know, when you start at Wolf Connection, when you get to actually enter the enclosures and scoop poop, it's really an honor for us here. So you are not alone in that area at all. I want to ask you, because I don't think it was the New Yorker article, but there was another one, and I love diving right in with this with you, because you, especially, talk about your early work in the California Wolf Center, because you really dove right in and you were having these discussions with ranchers, individuals who had livestock. And so what were your duties there at the California Wolf Center to start? And then how did you get integrated into speaking with individuals who own livestock and home farms and livestock and things of that sort?
Well, I actually got started with a grant for a development position. Really knew nothing about it. Read a lot and interviewed, got hired. and then, you know, originally as the director of California Wolf Recovery, you know, I looked at it as an advocacy role. And I was pretty hardcore, you know. I was taught certain things and learned certain things. And I would go to hearings and stand up and testify about wolves, 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 and maybe ranchers aren't such the good people, you know, the story. and just very classic, right? But Cal Wolf Center in general looked at things differently. You know, they were part of the Mexican Wolf Fund and all that program down there. And the founder of a lot of these programs, Patrick Valentino, is quite the visionary. And so he was a mentor. But really what changed was when I participated as a member of the stakeholder working group. And there was the hunting caucus, the environmental caucus, and the ranching or livestock caucus and or ag caucus. And I remember sitting there, and I didn't speak up for a while because I was overwhelmed by all these brilliant minds. And it was just, it wasn't going right. You know, I saw the environmental folks, these scientists come prepared with their arguments, their science, their this, their that. And these producers who are just trying to ranch and full-time ranching, you know, it's not their whole job to come prepared to argue, feeling out-scienced, outspoken. I saw the defeated look on their face, the frustration when they were trying to just share their stories. And there was something about them that just got my attention because it felt sincere. Like I realized that their fears that they came up with, their concerns they came up with, you know, rather they were perceived or real, they were real to them. And my heart just went out. Maybe it was empathy. I don't know what you call it. And I wasn't really proud of how maybe our group was handling some of it, you know, instead of coming to the table and talking to neighbors, it was like we're coming to talk with our enemies. So I decided at lunch to just start talking to them and learn more. And I remember speaking up a couple of times, and it wasn't necessarily in alignment with my colleagues and kind of getting, you know, hushed a little bit, going back to Patrick Valentino and saying, you know, this is what I'm seeing. And he's like, go for it. Just go for it. You know, just say what you need to say. You're right. Things need to change. And so I did. And then I ended up getting an invitation to a ranch, which led to invitations to other opportunities with livestock producers. And I just spent as much time as I could listening, learning, absorbing. And what I discovered was this whole new world. And I often say that it was like a veil was lifted in my understanding and perception. And at first I didn't know what to do with it because here I've been taught, you know, this one way of going about advocacy. And what I was saying was something very different. And I realized that I was only taught half the story, you know, and it's a lot more powerful to know the whole story, right? And I recognized that that other half of the story was just as equally valid and valuable and important. And that these were good people who cared about the land and their cattle and wildlife. And it really wasn't about the wolf. It was about what the wolf represented, you know, those that persecuted them or didn't understand them. And of course, a lot of handed down, you know, mythology there. And so it really changed my view. And I started looking back on the history of wolf recovery in this country. And again, I wasn't there like Carter and some of these folks. And actually, this is something that he shared with me early on, that these folks that did all this amazing planning and made it happen, which is amazing that it did happen. And they tried to do outreach to the ranchers and prepare socially as well as physically and biologically for this. Still, nobody was prepared for what was to come. You know, the tremendous celebration of over wolves across the West captured everybody's imagination. The tremendous conflict and controversy within ranching communities that weren't prepared. The tremendous divide between urban and rural communities. It just kind of blew up. And as we see wolves come from state to state, you know, at first people are excited and they celebrate them. Populations grow. They might lose protections. They kill a calf or two. You know, that lethal control comes in. And we're seeing the same story over and over again. Even though years go by, you'd think we'd learn, right? It's kind of like Einstein's theory, or he's accredited with saying, keep doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting a different result. And I thought, you know, and we celebrate that reintroduction is one of the greatest conservation stories of all time. And it is when you consider the fact of those that accomplished it, the ability for wolves to do what they do and what we did bringing back this iconic species. But I question, is it really successful when you consider the continued division, the continued conflict, not to mention the hardship on the wolf itself with lethal control? And there's nothing pretty about it. There's nothing clean about lethal control practices. How can we have yet to create a lasting environment for these critters? And then, as Carter would say, it's more of a people problem, right? And so I started thinking, well, maybe we should, you know, this is nothing is linear here. You know, wolf recovery isn't linear. You know, ranching isn't linear. People certainly aren't linear. Maybe we need to start looking at all three together on an equal playing field, if that makes sense. Kind of like that three-legged stool. You know, if that all three legs on that stool is strong, it's going to hold up the end result, you know, but if one is not there, it's going to fall. And we've all kind of in our corners approached just one. So I started looking at it through all of it. And that's what was kind of a game changer in my approach with ranchers.
I think I agree with Carter in that it does seem to, we were just saying this in the last podcast, which is it's hard to tell the difference between a problem between humans and wolves and a problem between humans and humans. And wolves are the scapegoat for the disagreement. How much do you think certain political environments not honoring or not respecting or not listening to certain communities that modern world seems to be out of touch with at this point, how much do you think not bringing their perspectives to the table plays a part in what we're seeing being played out between people and wolves?
All of it, to answer your question in short. You know, wolves have become this political instrument, a fundraising tool, icon of wilderness, you know, a scapegoat for all the urban problems, just for being a wolf and doing what they do, but very much so. And it's unfortunate because, again, oftentimes only half the story is told. Advocacy groups, you know, they have the money to put out a story, right? And oftentimes you have to have the villain, right? To raise funds, you know, in the ranch communities, they're just trying to, again, ranch. So again, it goes back to that not having the whole story, because wolves don't die because they eat an occasional cow, you know? And I remember thinking that. I'm like, okay, this doesn't make sense. Why do wolves really die? Why does lethal control really happen? And it comes back to that deeper social disconnect and getting at the root. So that's kind of, I guess, my approach was diving at the root of it. And I realized that, like, the ranchers we worked early on in California, you know, it's about relationships and sincerity. And I think because I actually really cared about them, wasn't just an agenda for wolves, and just with a little support and understanding. And, you know, suddenly the wolf wasn't an issue. They would get excited if they caught one on their game camera, heard one howl, because, you know, they felt heard and understood. And obviously we provided early support to implement, you know, these herd management strategies to help them. And they recognized that, yeah, they can share the landscape. It's not easy. But wolves don't need to exist at the expense or exclusion of ranching. And ranching doesn't need to exist at the exclusion or expense of wolves. They each can actually benefit from each. And that's the amazing thing about this whole thing, is there is that win-win scenario right there at our door with all these new herd management strategies and range line management strategies, these more comprehensive approaches that help the rancher's economic bottom line. And guess what? They reduce vulnerability in cattle to predation. None of it's easy, of course. Change is not easy, but there is great hope.
Describe some of the things that you learned too, because I love that you're working the middle on this. And when you went to, I know Kathy and Tom DeForest, when you went to their ranch, that seemed to be, I guess, the light bulb turned on, or you really got your wheels spinning on that. Just describe, what were some of the things that you learned from them that sort of kicked this whole thing off for you to listen to them and implement these strategies?
Well, it was, you know, I went there thinking, oh, cool, you know, going to a ranch, part of my job, how exciting, you know, I really, you know, was still coming from my perspective. But I remember, you know, obviously the beauty in the open space and just the warmth of that family, Kathy and Tom DeForest, you know, when they were, and then when they walked us around and they were showing all these conservation projects they were doing, you know, restoring the stream bed, helping the Modoc, oh gosh, that fish, I can't remember his name all of a sudden, you know, all these projects they were doing conservation-wise and how well they knew the land. You know, they're on the land every day. They're working it every day. And how much they actually care for their cattle and how proud they are of them. And I remember I was sitting in the car with Kathy and I asked her, I said, you know, what is it about the wolf? You know, why is it you just dislike this animal so much? And she got all teary-eyed and she's like, I just don't want to think of one of my cows dying that way.
Right.
And I thought, wow, she really cares. This isn't just a product, you know, something she's selling, you know, they take great responsibility for the quality of life of these critters. And I was just like, wow. And that was just one of many, because she started my journey, invited me out to spend some more time on her ranch and put me to work. It was great. And then she opened the door to join this 4-day program, ranch to ranch. And I remember, because it was all ranchers and some BLM folks, and I was the only wolf person there. And every morning it was kind of a different group of folks. We were in a circle, and everybody would go around introducing themselves. And then when I said who I was, it was this gasp, you know. You know, but it was, it really helped build a lot of the relationships, you know. And I began just focusing my effort, you know, supporting wolves by supporting those that are actually living and working with them, being in the context where the wolf lives, you know, and recognizing these peoples as stewards of the land where these predators reside. And the fact that through these responsible grazing practices, you can improve habitat health, increase prey populations that the wolves need, and they won't eat the cows. So there's just a lot of dynamics, but through that, I was able to go to a 3-day program in Montana at Hillary and Andrew Anderson's place there. And that's where some of these more comprehensive herd and range management strategies and rekindling the herd instinct, low stress livestock handling, some of these other more nuanced practices were first introduced. And I recognized early on that that was the key, because they were long-term and sustainable. They helped the ranchers. Besides the wolf, they were beneficial to the ranchers. And so I continued to spend time on their ranch and cultivate those relationships, and Working Circle kind of became all about that. So
it's a very interesting story, because it really is so easy to assume that when ranchers don't want wolves returning to the landscape that really makes up their backyard, that the perspective is completely focused on the wolf. It's anti-wolf at its core. And when you put it this way, that these cattle are really a source of pride for them and a symbol of generations that have passed and those to come, that they can't imagine one of their cattle being, you know, in a very real sense, torn apart in a way that to some humans might look very traumatic. I'm living on a ranch right now, and I was just thinking, the owners here are not anti-wolf, but they're definitely pro their cattle. They care about their quality of life, and they do a lot to give them a good life every day. For them to imagine one of them being killed by a pack of wolves, I could imagine would be tough, even though they are not actively anti-wolf. Do you find that this particular fear is the driving perspective amongst ranchers, or is this kind of an exception to the rule?
No, there's definitely that fear. I see that over and over again, you know, because wolves, their hunting strategy is not pretty. It's not quick, you know, it's a horrible way for an animal to go down. So that's definitely part of it. And, you know, and then these, and also the fact that they've invested the genetics, you know, that one, it's not just the value of that one calf or one cow, you know, there it's the generations of genetics potentially lost. So there is the economic side of it as well. And then again, it goes back to what that wolf represents and why they're there. You know, and a lot of it is passed down mythology too, because unfortunately, you know, they've learned a lot of stories about wolves, you know, that they hunt for fun, or, you know, that they're these vicious killers. And that's because that's what they've been taught and told. So you can't judge them for that, because that is, you know, been handed down. You know, they actually believe this. It's a cultural thing. So you have to recognize that as well. But, you know, like I said, in some of the ranchers we've worked with, part of our thing when we work with them and train is, with Carter's help, you know, whole thing about wolf behavior, biology, and ecology, you know, so they kind of get the truth about that, as well as the rangeland management. But once they have those tools, they feel like they can manage it. And if nothing else, through these strategies we promote, the idea behind this ranch resiliency is that they can absorb loss, you know, economically if they lose one or two cattle. So it's more of an emotional loss and economic loss. because a lot of times when ranchers say, no, it's the last straw, you know, it's the last straw, and because they do face so many challenges in the modern world, it generally means that maybe their ranch isn't as strong as it could be. So how do you create a stronger foundation? So when the wolf comes along, it's just another storm. You know, it's not the end of the world. They can weather that, right? And, you know, so there's different ways to look at this whole picture. And we always say, you know, ranchers can't make good management decisions based on myths surrounding the wolf, and wolves and wolf advocates can't make good advocacy decisions based on myths surrounding ranchers. So again, make sure you know the whole story before you judge or put things out there, because sometimes we will say and do things that are very counterproductive to the cause we claim to serve. You know, like if we go and say, get rid of public grazing, you think that rancher is going to want to support us supporting wolves? No. If the ranchers are out there saying SSS, you know, shoot, shovel, and shut up, you know what I tell them? You really think you're going to get urban market support? You think you're going to help stop the vegan movement, you know, with that kind of talk? You know, think about your actions and the words you say. Is it helping your cause, or are you just fueling the flames that has hindered wolves, livestock, and people to be able to exist in peace on shared landscapes?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. This has become more of a topic that Stephen and I have been talking about, I feel like, over the last four or five episodes, and it just keeps continuing. So what are some of the strategies that your group is doing to help the ranchers become more economically stable and that their ranches can sustain any of the different storms, as you said, that can come in there? And how do you play? I read this somewhere else that they say you were playing the radical middle, which I thought was very apropos of this conversation, because, and it's such a great use of those words, because we always think about the peripheries and not there. So it's a multi-layered question, so I apologize for that. So just how do you train these livestock places and these farms to continue to exist and profit while living with wolves, and then also playing the radical middle, like you were explaining before?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, really does come down to those relationships first and building the relationships. And I don't hide to anybody that I love wolves to pieces. I think they're amazing, wonderful, and they have an inherent right to be on the landscape, free from human value judgments or persecution. You know, so I think part of that is just being sincere. But again, you know, I'm also very sincere in caring and wanting ranchers to be successful on the landscape. And so you have to actually start, I know your question was the opposite, but you have to start from that radical middle space first to even get to the conversations that allow you to move in those other directions. And obviously I'm not the one doing it. I might have the street smarts, but I'm still the wolf person. So I look at my role as serving the ranching community, you know, because it's not a one-shoe-fits-all scenario. You know, every operation's different, every situation's different, landscape's different, cattle are different, and also facilitating. So we've been very fortunate to work with folks that I have trained under, you know, Montana, like Hillary and Andrew Anderson, Whit Hibbard, these folks, and other regenerative ag-focused experts, and Joe Engelhardt, of course, is one of our longtime partners. And these are ranchers that are living it, and they're experienced in these herd and rangeland management techniques. And basically, it's going back to what's called the nature's model and bringing cattle back to how they would be in the wild. You know, we have taught them through, you know, a lot of it's regulation, you know, on Forest Service lands, but, you know, to scatter, right? A lot of times you'll see cattle scattered over the landscape. And in a lot of ways, they've kind of lost that herd mentality. So what we try to do is, you know, if ranchers are going to raise prey like cattle in predator country, the idea is to make their prey the least vulnerable prey on the landscape, right? Because wolves go after vulnerability. Well, any predators do, right? Wolves focus and they know. And if that cat, if those cattle and those calves are the least vulnerable out there, they'll stick to their, you know, their preferred prey, elk, deer, whatever else that might be. And so that's kind of the goal. And so what Hillary actually discovered when she was working in Yellowstone years ago is she saw how, you know, the wolves would kind of test their prey. You know, they're very risk averse. They're always weighing risk to their safety and vulnerability of prey, right? Because, you know, they're not big, strong animals. They have to work in these teams and they have to attack from behind because of the hooves and the horns and all the thing, antlers that can cause serious damage. So they, you know, find that vulnerability and they take it down. And so the idea is to get elk to run, right? They want them to run, not face them. Bison group together and face them. Well, it turns out that the mentality of cattle are a lot more like bison than elk. But what happens now, what you see a lot of times is, you know, mama cows are here and their babies are way over there and they're kind of spread out. Wolves or a predator comes along, mama panics, takes off, baby's left behind, you know, dinner for the wolf. So the idea is to rekindle that herd instinct. But to get there, you have to first change how cattle are handled. Kind of get away from the Yahoo noise and, you know, shock, you know, probing and the paddles and all the things that you see, right? The cowboys, that stresses the cattle out. You know, they move, they look at you as or the ball, they look at you as prey, and it's very inefficient. And the cattle are already in a state of stress. Right? They see you coming and they're like, ah, you know, whereas low stress livestock handling doesn't, the true Bud Williams low stress livestock handling doesn't mean you're necessarily going really slow and quiet all the time, but you're working with the cow's psychology. You're not a predator. So it's how you move your horse or how you, if you're on the ground, move, you know, where you stand within their view, where your energy is. And there's these great videos that Hillary has of this one ranch where the ranchers are trying to get their cattle through this corral and down this one chute. And they're just all over the place. And they had five people and they brought in more people and it was just a mess. And then Bud Williams alone, one person, walks into the same corral, same cattle, out making noise, never raising his hands, quietly without any bawling, gets all the cattle. And it's like magic. You think he's just, you know, like talking to them somehow. But it's really through this, it is an art form and it takes time. But also takes time to condition the cattle. It can take three generations to get them there. So once the cattle are conditioned and in a different place and their cortisol levels are lower, it naturally increases the sense of confidence. And then through that, you can start to rekindle that herd instinct, meaning through moving them and grouping them and settling them, you know, they learn to stay together as a herd and they recognize that the safe place is the herd. And that's what you want them to know. The safe place is the herd. But you, as the handler, have to make the safe place the herd. And again, that takes time. But once they get that, it's amazing because I'll see Andrew or folks out there, what happens, a predator comes, mama stands up, if she's sitting, laying down, whatever, looks for her baby first, picks her up, they go in their little group, and they stand and they face the predator. They don't run. And so they're not vulnerable, and the wolves leave them alone. So not only does it reduce vulnerability, it also reduces the cattle stress to predators. You know, one of the big arguments of ranchers is, well, it's not just they kill occasional cow, but the stress level, you know, the cortisol, because the predators are there and they're moving and they're not eating, so they're not gaining the weight. Well, it affects that too. So what do you have? You've got healthier or better meat quality. You have higher conception rates. You have healthier calves. You have lower illnesses. So that alone helps that ranch resiliency. Then through these grazing, rotational grazing practices, you're improving the land health. So the grass is more nutrition. So for every one bite of grass, they're getting the nutrition of three bites. So they can actually have more cattle on the landscape. And it just goes on and on and on from there. It's kind of complicated. I could talk about this all day, as you can tell. But so the same strategies that lower vulnerability also increase the bottom line for ranchers.
Wow, you're blowing my mind right now, because this sounds like a genuine, it sounds like a long-term viable solution to coexistence. It's always refreshing to me to hear that we've sort of messed with something too much, and the answer is a simplification of the process, not to overcomplicate it, a returning back to a natural order of things, and a more natural, if I'm hearing this right, a more natural human-cattle relationship will yield a more natural predator-prey dynamic, which sounds like a permanent solution.
Well, it's comprehensive and it's long-term. So, you know, range riders, they say, oh, human presence, Lowells are smart, right? They figure out when you're out there. The beauty of this is you can move your cattle in a place and check them 4 days later. You know, it doesn't require you being out there all the time with them. And that is efficient. And you can do with one person what it took five people. So yeah, it's pretty neat, but it takes a lot of practice, a lot of time and a lot of initial effort, but the long run pays off, you know? And I always think that if we do our job right, we're out of a job. You know, we set up the ranchers to self-manage and self-lead it, and we can just stay out of it. And they're happy to do so. That's what they want. They want all us wolf people out of their business.
What's the success rate that you guys have had, and how have you seen the program sort of advance and take hold with some of the ranchers that you've worked with? Have you seen this take hold where they're teaching other ranchers, or are there ranch instead of you guys teaching it? Have you seen that progression happen?
Yeah. So, you know, again, first of all, even though I feel like I could, I'm not the one that teaches it. We have ranchers that teach it. So it's rancher to rancher. So I don't want to be the whole person, right, telling them what to do. But yeah, so I'll just give you a quick story. And so, you know, we've always wondered as we work in these different regions of their ranches, you know, does this really work long term? You know, we keep the same relationships. Like the first ranchers I worked with in California, I was just talking to one of them today. We're still friends. We still communicate. But we had spent a lot of time on one particular region, and there were wolves at the time. And that we sent these folks to Montana to, some of them went three times, you know, kind of basic training, advanced training. We had folks come spend time with them on their ranch. We did risk assessments, co-created plans, you know, a lot of initial investment. And then the wolves left that area and settled somewhere completely different, right? So no wolves in this area. We're like, oh, great, nothing. Yeah, but it's still there. They still loved it and they still continued to do it because it helped in other ways. Well, fast forward now, we have wolves moving into the area. And some of the producers that we haven't worked with started to panic, raise the alarm, the hype, right? And with COVID, we were kind of stuck. We're like, oh my gosh, we felt helpless. But it was amazing because the original ranchers we worked with years ago on their own stepped up, reached out to their neighbors, talked to them, did the surveying, you know, did the risk assessments, started implementing strategies with them, cultivated those relationships, and all on their own. Didn't cost us a penny, didn't have to do a thing. And there's no hype. And even more wolves are coming into that particular area. And they're doing it on their own. And it's phenomenal because it's like it's the first time I feel like I've had any sort of other than anecdotal, you know, proof, so to speak, that with a little understanding and support, amazing things can happen. So pretty darn exciting. And now it's fun because I hadn't talked to any of the new ranchers yet, you know, because I was just standing by, you know, but now they're ready to talk to the wolf person, you know, looking at maybe the summer, sending them to Montana so they can get that experience. But to see how sustainable it is and how it's literally like for every one rancher we touched, you know, four families have been positively impacted, you know? So it just kind of has that. And that, could you imagine, you know, you think about the amount of money we put into compensation and these tools, you know, you know, if we could just finally create a lasting environment, you know, for wolves, livestock and people to just exist and thrive on these shared landscapes without spending millions of dollars in an approach that neutralizes that polarizing debate, really, because it's a, you know, the people who want wolves get their wolves. Those that want to make sure that they have a viable operation or their grandkids are going to inherit their ranch can have that. Those that manage wolves have an easier time, you know, and because of the wolf, it's created this situation. That's when I talk about each can benefit from each. I think as a human race, we can learn a lot from wolves in general and what's happening here. But so, yes, I have seen it work. And my hope is to be able to take that and scale it in Colorado before the reintroduction, you know, because it does take time. And to focus, you know, a lot of effort here. And then we also do work in Southern Oregon as well. So,
yeah, I was going to bring that up because Colorado is, I mean, I know we're roughly a little over two years away from that, but it's, you know, 2 years can go by fairly quickly. What's the strategy for Working Circle at the moment, as you said, to sort of get ahead of the reintroduction so that there's a preparedness there when the wolves eventually get dropped in, or depending upon where they go? I know they're going to the western side of the state. So what's the plan for Working Circle in that regard?
Well, we started actually a couple of years ago just trying to get a feel of some of the landscape areas and kind of the ranching culture here. And we did focus in some of the areas where we know we have wolf activity. Last summer, we camped pretty close to the Moffett Pack, which is pretty amazing. Because you can't create a coexistence plan or strategy unless you understand the landscape first. So understanding the landscape in terms of topography, prey, movement, wolf activity, and also initial risks, you know, obviously seeing how the cattle are now. Then looking at areas that could be potential wolf habitat. So we started doing that. And then just naturally by doing that, you know, we run into livestock producers and have conversations with them. It's so funny because I'd be like, oh, you one of those wolf people? I'm like, well, not, depends on how you define those wolf people. Might be a crazy wolf person. I mean, crazy, comma, wolf person, but not a crazy wolf person. So, you know, so that kind of helps those initial conversations. And then obviously, you know, we try to be really transparent and support, you know, the agencies in charge of this. We don't want to step on toes. So any information we learn or we get images of the wolves, you know, sharing that. And then we also did some workshop series, and the workshops are kind of a snapshot, if you will, of what we can maybe offer long term. And the idea is to just initiate conversation. We're not going to teach everybody in a day, but we have, you know, Joe Engelhardt talk. It's always people talking from their experience. Like, I don't even talk other than introduce folks. And then Carter talks about wolf biology and ecology, because we find in talking to ranchers that a lot of times they don't even understand this critter. And then Hillary talking about these range management, herd management strategies. And again, everybody talking from their opinion, from their experience, because again, no landscape's the same, right? A lot of discussions. And that helps you meet folks that way, right? You have conversations that way. So moving forward, now that I'm vaccinated, I want to get back out there and, you know, start doing some outreach. Maybe it's just hosting some town hall meetings, giving some presentations, doing some workshops, and start building those relationships. And then hopefully this summer, maybe there'll be some folks willing to go to one of the Montana trainings. And then start having folks like Joe or Hillary and Andrew come here and work with ranchers and just kind of implement that model, you know, do the risk assessments, co-create the plan. Obviously, we're not going to tell anybody what to do. The idea is by spending time together, they come up with ideas that, you know, meets folks where they're at. And sometimes producers are just looking for a resource, somebody to call, you know, others want all in, the whole program. And then part of it is financially supporting some of the range stewards, kind of our version of the range rider, but it's that comprehensive training program, you know, supporting them initially financially to kind of kickstart their program. But the idea is not to create long-term reliance. So that's the hope. We'll just reach out and do our thing. You know, we're very focused on the ground in the community and meeting people where they're at.
Yeah. I feel like there's a unique approach that you guys have. You have these, you have yourself, you have the rancher who you were talking about who helps you out. Carter helps you out. Carter Niemeyer helps you out. When we say Carter, by the way, we're meaning Carter Niemeyer. I know people are probably like, who's this person, Carter? So it seems like there's this three-pronged approach that you're able to, it's almost as though you're able to meet everyone on whatever level they need to, and you have the tools and the individuals to do that. Do you see, it seems as though there's success in that, because it's not just coming from a pro-wolf person, a scientist perspective, a former rancher. It's you have this three-headed tool in your toolbox that you can use to really get this to move forward.
I guess that's true, you know, because it really, everybody's needs is different, and anything we do needs to be reflective of what their needs are, where their challenges are, and what they're ready to do and engage in. And so we kind of put it out there and say, we're here. And I think we are fortunate because we have a dynamite team. You know, Carter's been an amazing mentor. Hillary and Andrew have been amazing mentors. I feel so fortunate to have had some of the real in-depth experiences with them. And Joey Englehart, my gosh, that man's amazing. And also working with some of the agency folks. We've had a chance to do so in California and Oregon. So it really is about that. So it's not like a linear strategy. You know, sometimes it starts A, sometimes it might start, you know, an N, you know, and depending on what we have going to, and then work from there. So if those conversations spark further interest, great. You know, it's a lot of sitting around and just talking, you know, creating the circles, so to speak, between the diverse people. And recognizing that we really have the same outcomes that we want. We want you to succeed on the landscape. And we recognize your value as those living on the landscape for my needs and wanting moles, you know? But even beyond that. So it kind of goes again, I keep saying that, I know, back to those relationships. That's the core of it, and trust and sincerity. You know, I can't just do this because I want moles, you know? It's pretty amazing. It's very rewarding. It's not always easy, obviously. You know, people can be hard and gets frustrating, and it's a roller coaster, a lot of tears at times. But we got to keep pushing that needle forward in a better way. I know we can create a brighter future for these critters in the working lands they call home. I've seen it happen. We've got the strategies to do it. You know, it's about creating this transformation of mindset, you know. Not necessarily about the physical solutions.
So from a personal standpoint, do you feel like you're doing this for the animals, or does it feel like there's multiple layers?
There's definitely multiple layers. I started out doing this just for the wolves. And I have to be honest, now I'm getting emotional. Sorry. I honestly am also doing it for the ranching community. I love them just as much as I love wolves, even though I'm not a rancher. Maybe I was in a rancher in a past life. Who knows? But I feel very passionate about them succeeding on the landscape. I love working with wolves. I love being out there with them. I want them to survive. I will advocate for them till the day I die. But let's say wolves weren't a part of this. I would be a rancher advocate full time, you know, and just try to create greater awareness in urban communities or with, you know, environmental communities of the need to understand where these people are at. Now, of course, you've got bad apples everywhere. Not all ranchers are wonderful, and not all advocates are, you know, I mean, we're human, we're people. But I've seen so much beauty there and value there. So yeah, I love wolves and I love the ranching community. So it's kind of a weird dichotomy, but so I guess this radical center comes very natural to me. And it's certainly nothing I expected because I think back at some of the things I used to say at those hearings, you know, yikes. I just don't ever want those to surface again.
Do you feel like there are more people like you out there in the radical middle? I think actually we're going to steal that, John. We always say gray area, but radical middle is way cooler. Do you feel like you meet more people in the radical middle in this conversation, or do you think you're an exception?
Well, I think there are more people wanting to be there than they even want to admit. Because I have found with, like, when I go to give a presentation on wolves, who get invited to talk on wolves, I always bring in the rancher story, which at first kind of shocks people. But what I find is they're just so grateful. They're so tired of the wolf wars, of the us versus them, the negative, negative, negative. So they're hungry for that. There's no doubt. Sometimes it's hard, though, because, you know, whether you're talking to a rancher or you're talking to a wolf advocate, when you're talking about values, when you're going to those core values, you know, those are identity based, right? And so it's harder sometimes for people to leave that because it is so identity based. Does that make sense? You know, because it is about values. It's not about changing people's minds. It's about recognizing the values and working within that. But then there are those that just won't, and maybe it's just not in their DNA, you know, and I guess that's okay too. So I think there are more people drawn to that. Sometimes they just don't even realize it. But there's no doubt I still come up with you know, I get told by some folks in the environmental community, I'm just a rancher lover now and I don't care about wolves. And, you know, and that's not true, because I've, in a lot of ways, I feel like we've done more good for wolves by taking this approach, you know, not more. It takes a village, right? People have to come at this. Wolves need all the help they can get from all different angles. Yeah, so the radical center space, just so you know, I did borrow that. I didn't realize that it was actually coined by Rick Knight at CSU. And there's this wonderful book called, it talks about the radical center space, called Revolution on the Range. And if you read nothing else but the prologue, it'll change how you look at the whole world. It made me in tears because I read that and I went, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. So there are other people doing this and that have done this. You know, so that's been really refreshing. So I used to think, gosh, you know, why am I the only one doing this? But I'm not. There's a lot of people in that radical middle space. And it is a cool term. So I borrowed it too. So it's okay.
Yeah, we're taking it.
No, we're definitely taking it. But you're right. Everything that you've said is the basis of the connection that Stephen and I, we started the podcast on this premise, is that there is this connection that needs to be forged, you know, and more so as we get along this journey through everyone who doesn't necessarily agree on everything. But there's a way that we can, and everybody just wants to be recognized, like you said before. People want to be recognized. They want to be heard. They want their voice to be put into the circle so that it's a collective effort, because no one person or no one group or is going to make the headway in order for some sort of balance to come out of this. And as you stated multiple times throughout in explaining it beautifully in, with your experience, is that this is the way, this seems like such a refreshing way to handle this situation, so that everyone can get what they want and what they need, and so that there's some sort of collective unity, and that it won't just be a group here and there doing it. Then you'll almost have an army behind whoever's leading this charge to say there is a better way, and there's always a better way to do these things.
Yes, you're right. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit earlier, but, you know, folks often talk about, we have to come to the middle, you know, you have to compromise, compromise, compromise. But the problem with that is oftentimes that can be a stumbling block, because if you're compromising, it often means giving up something of deep value, and that's hard. So what we're trying, what we're recognizing that we have a rare opportunity here, which you don't often see, where we don't have to compromise at all, because these strategies do create that win-win scenario that I already talked about. And it's like, come on, let's just do it. Let's go for it. and so, you know, I'm very idealistic, but I've seen it work. It works, you know, it works. But again, it takes a village. There's a lot of amazing groups out there doing incredible work, and folks have to come at this all from different angles. We just have to be careful of what it is we do put out in the world. You know, is it helping or hurting?
I agree 100%. How do you see this? How do you see Working Circle, you know, continuing on? And are you stretching into other states? I know you talked about Oregon, I think, a little bit, obviously in Colorado. What's the goal for Working Circle? Are you looking to help the entire western portion of the United States with this? What's the end, or what's the continuation of Working Circle?
I think that would be the ultimate goal. And the idea is to create these regional hubs or whatever that are self-sustaining, right? Because it's not sustainable, right? If you keep putting money into strategies everywhere, more wolves come, you know, obviously. So to spark what we started, you know, in the first region and see that happen in other regions. And then hopefully, even as wolves expand into California, you know, instead of us having to jump back, you know, these other regions, you know, what started one area can then grow organically. So that's the hope. So we're hoping here, obviously Colorado, we have to be very aggressive very quickly, but also you can only move as fast as the cause will allow, and as the circumstances on the ground dictate, right? So you have to be careful not to be too aggressive. And then obviously Oregon, but yes, we'd love to. I mean, Wyoming, that's a tough one, you know. Montana, obviously we have partners in Montana, but we'd love to continue to see how this goes. My hope is that if we can kind of, with all eyes on Colorado, have a positive outcome, that it could be maybe an example in the light, you know, that can reflect back to some of these other states. And then, you know, absolutely, I'd love to see this grow. And it doesn't necessarily have to be me, you know, there's others that can implement the same idea. You know, we don't have ownership of, you know, we're not territorial, you know, over anything. I always say a working circle was created by many, it belongs to everybody, you know. But to see this model, so to speak, the strategy grow. And maybe even, you know, back to the Red Bulls as well. It doesn't have to necessarily be in the West. We've always said the West. But who knows? Who knows? I kind of think of it almost as a movement, not to sound corny, you know, that folks can adopt and we can help facilitate people. If people have the right intention, they're sincere and they care, it can happen.
Absolutely. I love it. Because, yeah, I think Colorado is going to be it's literally the middle. Because when we spoke to Mike Phillips about this, when he was discussing about the Colorado reintroduction, he made some sort of a statement that basically Colorado is that middle section that's going to bring, really sort of connect the northern part of the United States and the southern part, where wolves can essentially have that causeway to go back and forth. So it's going to be on everybody's mind, obviously, you know, in the next, you know, 2.5 years, to see how that reintroduction is going to go and how, you know, your group and others, I guess, are going to try and help prepare for that to come to pass.
Yeah, well, maybe it'll end up being the working circle. You know, we can really solidify things here. It can then have that concentric circle effect outward. So yeah, that's brilliant. I should write that one down.
I think what he was saying too was that the middle section also, it sort of solidifies the genetic diversity that's required to consider it, you know, this total package successful reintroduction to the West.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely will connect the northern populations with center populations. And, you know, even the Mexican gray wolf could use some genetic, you know, injection in there, though that's somewhat controversial. Some people think it's a great idea, others don't. But absolutely, connecting through the Rockies, it would be amazing, you know, but we have to do it in a meaningful way. We have to be thoughtful. You know, I want to see it. I would prefer that it would happen naturally, because I've seen already, you know, the challenges, you know, this process has created or enhanced. But I think if we're thoughtful, and you know, and it'd be hard considering Wyoming and some of the other places for it to, you know, wolves have struggled to get here and to establish themselves here. But if we're thoughtful moving forward, there's huge opportunity here. Absolutely. To not only help the wolf, but to create that lasting landscape for the wolves as well as the people.
Absolutely. Karen, I have one more question for you. When you hear the word wolf, what is something that comes to your mind?
So many things. But I think what I love, or one of the things that always impressed me about this animal, when people ask, you know, because for ranchers, it's very personal. They'll always ask you, forget the ecological value. Why? And, you know, they're one of the only animals in nature, wild animals, that take care of their sick, injured, and elderly, even when resources are short. They don't follow necessarily the normal survival of the fittest. That's pretty socially sophisticated. Right. So I think of that all the time. But they're just, I don't know, the sound of their howl. You know, if I'm out there camping with them and listening to them, there's something soulful. I think they're going to teach us a lot. There's just something, I don't know. I don't know if I could define what that is, what I feel when I hear the word, or when I look at a picture, look at your t-shirt, which I know folks can't see with the wolf. It just goes so deep. It's so deep, you know? And it's so cute. I get these young kids sometimes, usually these gals, if you'd have read the article or whatever, and they reach out, you know, through an email, and I'll do a Zoom call with them. And I always ask them, and when I taught at the California Wolf Center, I'd always ask the young folks, you know, why do you like wolves? Where? And they never know. And their parents, like, they're just born with it. It's like, it just seems like something that, you know, whereas usually they can point to when they started liking horses or whatever. But, you know, I guess I just hope that this critter can teach us humans something. I know they have already, but maybe they can help bring us to a better place as a society through all of this.
That's the plan.
Just for being a wolf. I just want to have a find a mate, have puppies, do what they do. They don't even know the burden that they carry on their back, but they do. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. You know, they're just doing as nature intended. They're wolves.
Yep. Well, if we could clone you a few hundred times, I think this process would move a lot quicker. Oh,
that's very really kind. Yeah, well, there's a lot of amazing people out there doing incredible work, for sure. And even what you're doing, just educating folks, creating that awareness is key, right? The more people can understand the whole picture, the more we can move forward.
Yeah, that's been the best part of doing this podcast, just meeting just incredible people one after another. So, it's so inspiring. It's so cool. But I think, I think the work that you're doing, which is starting where it counts.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I just think that at least on the coexistence side, it's not a behind the desk exercise or paper exercise. You got to be on the ground, you know, in the context of where they live, you know, so. And I like it. Much rather be there than sitting behind the desk anyways. So.
I can agree with you.
You guys do amazing things too. You know, I did read your website and look at all the good work you do. And so thank you so much.
No, we.
But like I said, it takes a bunch of people who care, you know, willing to step out and do it.
No, it's appreciated. It's appreciated. Thank you, Karen. This was great. And Stephen's right. The work that you're doing and the just the relationships that you guys are building is just phenomenal. And it's only moving in a positive direction. From you gave me more hope today. So I'm good. That gives me onus to continue. So I love it. Karen, just tell everybody where can they find information on Working Circle and in any social media outlets that you guys are at. Let everybody know.
Yeah, certainly. So our website is just www.workingcircle.org. A lot of great resources on there as well as general information. Of course, if folks want to support us, you know, we are a nonprofit. but, you know, that's really it. We don't really engage in social media and go down that route because, you know, working with the ranchers, confidentiality, you know, just privacy is important and we want to respect that. So we just try to do our thing. Yeah, you know, sometimes it can be challenging when you're trying to get the word out, but you know, so I always encourage folks to go to the website and learn more about us, look at the resources if they want to learn more about the issue in general. Reach out anytime to have a conversation. I'd just rather have a conversation. But we don't have a Facebook page or any of that, just mainly it just helps our work better that way. You know, we have so many great stories that we can't share because we do protect ranchers' confidentiality.
Yeah, makes sense.
That's phenomenal. I love that approach. I love what you and your group and everybody are doing, just because you're taking everybody's privacy and individuality into everything that you do, and I love that. So it was great, Karen. This was fantastic. Please visit the website, everyone. Take a look at what Karen's doing. This was phenomenal. Thank you, Karen, for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was really my honor and my pleasure to talk with you folks. Really appreciate the opportunity. Onward.
Yeah, you're welcome back anytime. Howls to everybody out there, and Steve and I will be with you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Looking to support Wolf Connection or sponsor one of the wolves in our pack? Just go to wolfconnection.org, click on the donate tab, and find out more information.